Welcome everyone to today's Smart Macro segment, where as always, we're going to be speaking with our CIO here at Financial Sense Wealth Management, Chris Poplava. So Chris, I know that you are in the process of prepping a client letter. It's going to be sent out next week. The main idea is going to be whether or not it is time to get up and dance, or if investors are better off having a conservative tilt. The leading economic indicators are continuing to decline and are at recessionary levels, but it appears Wall Street has basically written off any chance of an economic downturn, a recession, and most people seem to be joining the party in the tech space. What are your thoughts on how investors should be navigating the landscape for the second half of this year?
Well, Chris, you know, obviously we have had a conservative tilt and have largely sat on the sidelines with a minimum risk posture, which a couple of years ago, if you had a minimum risk posture with a fair amount of cash, you got paid zero. Now with interest rates pushing 5.5%, cash is no longer trash. You can actually get a decent return. And when you look at a short-term T-bill annualizing a return of 5.5%, and so far this year, the Dow is up just 2%, that looks fairly attractive. You know, again, it's an annualized yield, right? So if you look at that over a six-month period, you're getting about 2.75%. That's actually better than what the Dow is doing. Now, you know, obviously the Dow is not doing as well as other benchmarks like the S&P, which is up double digits. But even if you take a look back and look at the same index, right, the S&P, but look on an equal weight basis, that's only up about 5.5%. For me, that doesn't sound like a roaring bull market, but more of a selectivity in terms of the technology shares. So essentially, what I wanted to do is reflect on this move that we've seen in the first half of the year. And if it is time to kind of get out of your seat and start dancing with everyone else. And, you know, when I was thinking about this, Chris, I was reminded of the saying of the former CEO of Citigroup, Chuck Prince, who famously said in July of 2007, just as the market was topping and as the housing crisis was starting to pick up steam, he was quoted as saying, "When the music stops in terms of liquidity, things will be complicated. But as long as the music is playing, you've got to get up and dance. We're still dancing." So, you know, those words came just before Citigroup basically went to zero. Bear Stearns blew up and basically, you know, all hell broke loose. So things can change on a dime. They really can. And while everything looks great on the surface, you have to kind of look back and think, you know, does it make sense? What are the drivers? What are the supports for the market? And that's essentially what we did, is we wanted to really kind of step back and look at, okay, is there something we're missing, or are we just not getting caught up in the hype? And so, you know, clearly when we look at the first half, we would probably say it was fueled by artificial intelligence, you know, the mania behind that, which pushed tech stocks to dizzying levels. I mean, you look at the huge returns in NVIDIA, and we, you know, basically decomposed the S&P's return. And what we found was that just three stocks, Apple, Microsoft, and NVIDIA, explained just under half of the entire S&P's return in three companies. I mean, that was astounding. And we read an article by a Bloomberg editorial, John Authors, and he was citing SocGen research, which looked at the biggest 10 companies' contributions to the S&P's return on a six-month basis going back to 1990. So over 30 years. And what we saw in the first 6 months of this year was the biggest contribution we have ever seen by the top 10 stocks in terms of their contribution to the S&P's return. We had never seen anything before like what we just saw. So it was extremely rare. And you have to kind of ask yourself, can that continue? And when we are looking at essentially what happens when you have a big return in, let's say, the NASDAQ or tech stocks, you know, how do they tend to perform after that point? What we found was we essentially looked at the first half of the year where the NASDAQ was up 25% or more, like it was this year. And prior to this year, we only found four occurrences. And in three of those, out of those four, the NASDAQ was down double digits in the second half of the year, essentially implying that after a huge run, it makes sense to take a pause and breather and pull back a bit and get back to more, you know, neutral levels to reset before you go higher. So we would not be surprised, and, you know, history would support this, where tech stocks are not likely to lead us in the second half of the year, that they're well overdue for a pause and unlikely to have their breakneck speed of returns that they had in the second half that they had in the first half. But the other thing we wanted to take a look at was looking at current valuations. So for example, let's say you did not own the tech sector. You did not own Apple's, the Microsoft, NVIDIA's. And again, the S&P is largely dominated by the tech sector. So buying the S&P is more or less, it's almost like putting a third of your money in the technology sector, just one sector. And what we wanted to see was, how do these big companies that, powered the market higher this year, Apple, Microsoft, NVIDIA, how do they, what is their valuation currently relative to the peak in 2007's valuations or the 2000 peak in valuations at the tech bubble? And we were pretty shocked by what we found. We didn't think it would be as extreme as it is. And so we just kind of want to break out some of these numbers. So what we did is we looked at the big four price multiples that people use for valuation. We used price to earnings, price to sales, price to book value, and price to cash flow. And we took the average of those relative, to how expensive they are to their 2007, 2000 peak. And what we found is that Apple's valuations as of now are 72% higher than the peak valuations we saw in 2007. They are nearly 200% more expensive than the valuations we saw at the bubble peak of 2000. It really is astounding. There's another chart that we saw recently, but we didn't put it in our piece for clients, is looking at Apple's cash balance relative to its market capitalization. And it is less than 1%. I mean, with a $3 trillion market cap and only $24 billion now in cash, I mean, Apple, in a sense, is spending all of its cash on buybacks, and their sales are negative on a year-over-year basis. So you're looking at a company with very little cash relative to the size of its market cap and a negative year-over-year revenue growth. And yet it's selling at nearly 200% higher valuation levels than 2000. Is that the kind of company you want to jump in and buy with both hands? I wouldn't think so. Now, Apple didn't participate in the tech mania of the 1990s as much as, let's say, Qualcomm or Cisco or Microsoft. And so when we looked at Microsoft, Microsoft was actually half the valuations of its bubble peak in 2000. Because again, that was in a really extreme period. But when we look at more normalized periods, let's say it's 2007 valuation levels, Microsoft is 43% more expensive than its 2007 peak. So clearly, Microsoft is not cheap. Apple is by no stretch of the imagination cheap at all. But really, the king of valuation expansion this year has been NVIDIA, which is seen as the lead dog in terms of the artificial intelligence race. And when we looked at NVIDIA, it is 451% more expensive than in 2007. Let me repeat that again. 451% more expensive today than its 2007 peak, and nearly double its valuations in 2000. And I want to give an example of this, just kind of the mania and how when you buy a mania, sure, it can go higher, but when you spread out your investment horizon, your returns are likely to be pretty poor. And I think it was Jim Bianco who was kind of pointing this out, but in 1999, at the end of the year, Jeff Bezos, the founder of Amazon, was named Person of the Year. And in 2007, in December, Amazon was selling at, I believe, around $5.75 a share, give or take. So, man of the year, a lot of hoopla about the coming e-commerce revolution. Now, again, all of the hype about Amazon was absolutely correct. We did have this massive change in terms of the dominance of e-commerce that Amazon fueled. However, you were basically paying for all that future growth all up front, because in 2000, people were paying more than 40 times Amazon's current sales. 40 times. Within less than 2 years, Amazon's stock fell to less than 28 cents. It fell more than 95%, Chris, in less than 2 years, because people were overpaying for its future growth. Now, I bring that up because when I'm looking at NVIDIA, guess what people are paying for NVIDIA's sales? They are paying 40 times sales, just like they were with Amazon back in 1999, just as the market was peaking. So I really wanted to highlight this to clients because there is this kind of fear of missing out, you know, FOMO, in terms of the AI revolution, as well as the performance in tech, thinking that this is going to continue. What I'm bringing the attention to is, in terms of its valuations, there is tremendous amount of risk when you're buying quality companies with extreme valuations. There's no doubt that Apple is a quality company with a strong balance sheet. Same thing with Microsoft and Nvidia. And these companies are all likely to participate with artificial intelligence and benefit from it. But the question you have to ask yourself is that already embedded in the price? And I would have to say yes, based on current valuation. So that was a key thing I wanted to take a look at, because that's the question we're getting from clients is, you know, should we be overweighting tech? And we haven't. And is that something that we need to change? And that's why I really wanted to look at valuations to kind of answer that question. And when I bring up the valuation perspective, I think the clear answer is no, it does not make sense unless you're a momentum chasing trader, not an investor. I mean, buying something that is 451% above its 2007 peak, that doesn't sound like an investment to me. That sounds like pure speculation.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I've got some people that have contacted me that were previously pretty much against investing and just thought that the stock market was more of a casino, that are now coming around to the idea of, hey, I want to make a lot of money in these AI tech stocks and even trade options. So for me, that's a really big sign that, you know, there's been a major shift in the public psychology towards the stock market, which, again, we did see in the 2000s, and we saw that again with houses in the 2005 bubble. So there is a lot of bubble-like characteristics that we see. This was something that we've discussed on our podcast in the past. If you look at the Kindleberger framework that he developed in his book, Manias, Panics, and Crashes, regarding the common characteristics for bubbles, historically speaking, we see that today with tech stocks for the most part. And like you pointed out, these are good quality companies in most cases, whether or not you're talking about Microsoft or Apple, the typical list of those that are outperforming. They're good companies, but there's probably a little bit too much expectations for how much AI is going to improve their bottom line in the price today. And you can see that, as you said, in your research that we're going to be sending out next week to clients, looking at the fundamentals and just how far stretched they are away from there. Any other topics or points that you're discussing in this client letter that you believe investors should certainly be aware of as we consider, you know, the second half of this year?
Well, you know, one of the things that happened, I would say, just as the first half was coming to a close, was the advance by the S&P to 20% off of its lows of October of 22. And, you know, kind of a typical framework for describing bull or bear markets is that 20% threshold. For bear markets, obviously a decline, and bull markets, a rally of 20% off a significant low. And many were maintaining that we are now officially in a new bull market. The bear market is over, and that it's time to get fully invested and change your mindset. And, you know, again, as I mentioned previously, Chris, when we've seen the NASDAQ or technology shares have dramatic runs in the first half, more often than not, they take a cooling off period in the second half. So again, I don't think what fueled us in the first half is going to fuel us in the second half. So the question is, okay, if it's the baton is going to move hands from technology, what sector is going to take the baton from the technology sector? And particularly if we're in a new bull market, wouldn't you expect the rising tide lifts all boats to essentially mean that this bull market should be pretty broad-based? And so essentially what I want to do is to look at that period of essentially looking out 8 months from a bear market bottom, which is roughly what it took to rise 20% off the October lows. We were looking about 8 months, and, you know, to the day, it was about 254 days where we kind of finally hit that threshold. And so I looked at major bottoms in the last quarter century. So I looked at the 1998 Asian currency crisis and collapse of long-term capital management bottom, the 2002 technology bubble collapse bottom, the 2009 great financial crisis bottom, and a lesser bottom, but still one of significance where the markets really took off after it, was the 2016 bottom, which came after the Chinese currency devaluation of 2015 and global slowdown. And then I also took a look at the 2018 Fed rate hike fueled mini bear market, where Powell was raising rates pretty aggressively at the time, led to a mini bear market in the fourth quarter of 2018. And in December, we had basically the junk bond market in the U.S. seized up, where not a single junk bond was issued. And that caught Powell's attention, and we got, in January of 2019, the Powell pivot. And then lastly, I took a look at the 2020 COVID crash and looked at how the market performed 8 months coming out of that bottom. So we have, you know, several bottoms to kind of have a good framework to get a, you know, an idea of the character of what the market looks like when it started a new bull phase. And what I looked at using Bloomberg for screening, and a hat tip to John Krinsky, who, you know, highlighted this capability in Bloomberg, was looking at what the index did and what its median members performance was, looking out 254 days from those low points. And when I took the average S&P return over those bottoms, looking out again, 254 days, the S&P was up on average 39%. So again, we hit that 20% milestone, Chris, in 254 days, and that 20% rally was about half of what we normally see. So not particularly strong, and in fact, pretty weak when you look at prior advances looking out roughly 8 months from the lows. So again, half of what we normally see. And when I look at the S&P median member, the median member was up 42%. So essentially in all of those bottoms, the median S&P stock actually did better than the index, I think for all but one of those bottoms. But overall, you saw the median member up more than the S&P, up on average 42%. And more speculative indices like the NASDAQ and the small cap Russell did even better. The NASDAQ was up on average 54%. Its median member was up 33%. And the Russell 2000 was up 46%. And its median member was up 36%. So, you know, whether the median member did better or worse than the index, you know, regardless, you could see really strong returns coming out of the bottom. I mean, the, you know, looking at 33% for the NASDAQ, as high as 42% for the S&P's median member. So really strong returns. Now what I wanted to do is, okay, that's how the S&P, the NASDAQ, Russell index and members have performed over all those other bottoms. What does it look like currently coming off of October 13th, 22 lows? Again, you know, I used the 254 days because that was the threshold at which the S&P was up 20%. So we already know, obviously, the S&P was up 20%. The NASDAQ was up 28%. The small cap Russell was only up 7%. So that's very peculiar to see the Russell up a small amount relative to the NASDAQ and S&P. But that makes more sense when you understand that it really has been fueled by tech, which is a heavy influence in the NASDAQ and obviously a heavy influence in the S&P, but a much lesser extent in the small cap Russell. Now, let's look at the median member. So then S&P obviously was up 20%. Its median member, Chris, was only up 12%. So the median member is not in a bull market. It's only up 12%, which is a pretty small rally when you think of how dramatic the declines were last year. Now, when we look at the NASDAQ, we really see some major divergences. The NASDAQ is up 28%, 254 days after the October lows. Its median member, Chris, is down 2%. The NASDAQ has thousands and thousands of stocks within it, and the median stock is lower than the October lows. When I look at the Russell, again, the Russell is only up 7%. It's not even up double digits. It's median member. So again, we're looking at 2,000 small cap stocks. The median of those stocks is down 1%. So if you looked at the NASDAQ and looked at the Russell, and you looked at what is the stock market doing, and your definition of the stock market is more than just a handful of tech stocks, and it's looking at thousands and thousands of stocks, you have to ask yourself, what bull market? This is unlike any bull market we have ever seen compared to, you know, over the last quarter century. So to me, Chris, this smells more like 1999, where the market going up higher is really fueled by the mania behind tech shares, and it's not a broad-based rally that's going to be sustained when it is so narrow. That's what market tops are. Market tops are markets that are narrowing. And unless we see all these other stocks start to pick up speed here, I it's really hard for me to declare we're in a new bull market and throw in the towel and get up, you know, out of my seat and start dancing with the market. I think there's a lot of risk in doing that, particularly when, as I mentioned to you, how extreme the valuations are for some of these beloved tech stocks.
Let's shift gears over to the economy for a second. I know a lot of people are saying the fundamentals don't matter, as you addressed earlier, when we're looking at price to sales, price to book, or even PE ratios for some of these companies. But that being said, we did get some interesting data points this week. There was a blowout jobs number on the one case, and then another one that came under expectations. And many people pointing to the blowout jobs number that we got, saying that this just shows we're nowhere near a recession. What is your take on the economy as a whole?
Well, we have had a pretty decent jobs market and recovery. And I think a lot of that obviously is the shift from post-COVID recovery from goods towards services. And we had a lot of retirees, you know, the baby boomers retired en masse, particularly with a huge surge in their net worth from their homes and as well as their portfolios. And so a lot of people exited the workforce. And then obviously we had, unfortunately, you know, millions pass away from COVID. So we did see a hit to that. And so businesses were scrambling for labor to fuel demand. And again, this is particularly in the service sector. So, and that's more or less where we've seen a lot of the jobs being added is in the service sector. And so that was, you know, we've seen a pretty robust jobs market. But I think, Chris, we're kind of coming to the tail end of that, because when we look at the jobs report, which we just got today for June, the numbers came in at 209,000 jobs. That was the lowest jobs number, Chris, we have seen since 2020. So a two-year low, basically, in monthly job growth. And when we look at it, Chris, there's actually some more negative developments that we saw today. For one, when we look at the prior 2 months, which showed pretty robust job growth, those were revised down by 110,000 jobs. So basically, the prior 2 months were overstated by over 110,000 jobs. That's pretty significant. And again, this was the lowest job growth we had seen in 2 years. Now, I think we're going to start to see more and more slowing in job growth, because we're seeing lots of leading economic indicators in terms of jobs already rolling over. And so I think as the economy slows and as the consumer has largely driven down their excess savings from the pandemic and basically getting back to more normalized spending, I think we're going to continue to see job growth begin to slow. And I think the job losses are still ahead of us. And what's interesting, Chris, about this cycle, which is very different compared to others, again, the strength is in services. But when you look at the job losses are in white-collar jobs, those with, you know, six-figure salaries, computer programmers, those involved in tech. Well, the job growth has been in minimum wage workers. So on an aggregate, when you look at that, if you're hiring someone that's earning minimum wage and yet losing someone who makes six-figure salary, overall, your spending pattern should begin to weaken, because if you lose your job, obviously you're not going to be spending as much. You're going to be more conservative. And what's interesting, Chris, is, you know, there's two ways to look at the economy, right? There's gross domestic production, GDP, which most people use, but there's also gross domestic income, which measures economic growth by how much income growth there is in the economy. And when you look at GDI, we're already in recession. We have negative real GDI year over year. So from that standpoint, you could say we're already in recession. So the economy is not as strong as many would believe. And one of the things that I would like to point out, particularly when addressing the idea that there's no recession or we're in a bull market, when you look at the bank stocks, right? Because we all know credit is the lifeblood of the economy. What does it say to you when you look at the S&P Bank Index, which has the Wells Fargo's, the JP Morgan's, Bank of America's? That index is 16% lower than the lows it set in December of last year. When you look at regional banks are 27% lower today than where they were at their December lows. How does that look or sound like a bull market or an economy that is going to have a soft landing and reaccelerate? And, you know, essentially, Chris, I think we're just getting premature in terms of calling for the safe landing. We're still in that window of vulnerability. And one of the things I did recently is I took a look at the conference board's LEI, and when it turns and shows a negative 1% growth rate, that is the preceded recession every single time, no exception. And we hit that hallmark of negative 1% annual growth back in August of last year. We're currently just below negative 8%. And what I wanted to look at was the average lead time going into recession once that level was hit. The average was about 4 months, so that would have argued we would be in recession December of last year, and obviously we're not. But when you look at the longest lead time, which was the 2007 recession, because it hit negative 1% in 2006, that was about a 13-month lead time. So when you look at a 13-month lead time to August, that would imply September of this year. So, you know, we're looking in July, so we're still kind of in that window of vulnerability of recessions in terms of how soon they begin after the conference board's LEI falls to negative 1%. Also took a look at the yield curve and how long of a lead time that's given. And, you know, that can range again anywhere from, let's say, September to even, you know, February, March of next year. So, again, I think to declare the all clear is very premature. You know, anything's possible, but I think it's definitely premature because we all know monetary policy impacts the economy with a lag, right? And so to say that we've kind of dodged the bullet and we're in a new bull market, the economy is going to accelerate, I really think is premature. And so with that potential there and still in that window of vulnerability, for us, when we can get 5.5% with zero risk, zero volatility, that makes a lot more sense, especially when the average stock is not doing that well versus chasing tech stocks higher. Because just today alone, I was looking at the 30-year fixed rate mortgage. Chris, it's back up to 7.31%. That is basically matching the high seen last year. So with home values not falling that much from their highs and mortgage rates north of 7%, pushing 7.5%, who can afford a home, you know, at these prices and at these rates? And then also, as I mentioned to you, bank stocks are significantly lower than where they bottomed last year. And when you look at delinquencies, they're starting to pick up for auto loans, for credit card loans. And we know that student loans are going to have to start being repaid in the coming months here. We're probably going to start to see student loans go into rising delinquencies. And when you look at banks, especially the regional banks, which again, I mentioned are 27% lower than their last year's highs, it makes sense when you understand that when you look at their loan book, 44% of their loans are commercial real estate. Commercial real estate does not have a 30-year loan like residential does. Commercial real estates have much shorter maturities, which means they're going to be resetting earlier and feel the impact of the Fed's rate hiking cycle. We know that home equity lines of credit are adjustable. Those are feeling the pain. So I think, Chris, is just taking a little bit longer because so many people have basically locked in low rates, whether that's businesses or homeowners. But that pain is just being delayed, Chris, and people are holding out as long as they can. A good interview I listened to recently was by Mike Green from Simplify. And he had a stat that just blew my mind. And it was really a brilliant way, I think, of looking at the market. He looked at the entire U.S. junk bond market, and he looked at what percent of junk bond issuers had an operating profit recently from their Q1 reports. And what he found was about 85% of junk bond issuers had an operating profit. Now, again, if you're a corporation, a lot of your debt was issued when coupons were much lower, when your interest expense was significantly lower than, let's say, where it is today. But he had the really novel idea of saying, okay, they're obviously locked in low rates. However, their bonds, they're not selling at 100 cents on the dollar. They're selling at lower levels than that to reflect the stress that they're currently under. And if they're issuing new debt is issued at significantly higher rates than where the previously debt was issued at. So what he did is he took a look at, okay, what are they paying right now in interest? Now, let me replace that interest expense with what they would be paying at their current market rates. And what he found was that 85% profitability, Chris, that collapsed to 7. At current market interest rates, only 7% of junk bond issuers are showing an operating profit. That's scary. So think about that, an 85% drop down to 7. That's going to happen, Chris, obviously not all at once, but as more and more corporations are forced to refinance, that pain of the Fed rate hiking cycle has not been denied or pushed away. It's just been held off as far as possible. So I still think the pain, Chris, from all the Fed tightening still lays ahead of us. And I think there's a lot of risk of, you know, jumping into this market, particularly chasing tech stocks with record valuations here. It just doesn't make a lot of sense.
We've been speaking with our Chief Investment Officer here at Financial Sense Wealth Management, Chris Poplava. If you'd like to get in touch with us to speak with any of our wealth advisors about how we can help you with comprehensive financial planning services or asset management, you can do so by going to our website, financialsense.com, and hitting where it says Contact Us, or you can give us a call at 888-486-3939. Chris, thank you for coming on and giving us an update on your outlook, and we definitely look forward to speaking with you in another 2 weeks.
Thanks for having me on and look forward to it.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.